2013. I'm rapping. I'm still rapping. Rippity rap, rap, rapping. I'm still rapping, even if it doesn't sound like rapping. I wasn't rapping there for a second, but I'm back. And I'm still rapping. I'm Zach. What's about that? Hello, science fans from Canada, and also other places, last of which is probably St. Andrews. This is Fact Naturally. This week, I am your host. I am Zach. As always, I am joined by Dan.
Hi, my homies from Canada.
And I am joined by Dan. Wait.
Oh.
Where did you put? Yeah,
there's normally another guy here with us.
He sounds kind of like the Queen.
Yeah. The pip, pip, cheer. David is his name.
And scene. Hello, friends. This is a special episode of Fact Naturally. What makes it special is that we don't have to put up with David for any of it. This is actually, because we have all three of us, in case you don't know, our PhD students, and in case you didn't know, Dan and I are from Canada, but we're actually in Scotland, and sometimes David's going to be away for scientific endeavors, and I only get more excited each time. And this time he's away at a conference, but he will actually be away in the summer on field work. So we're trying something new out, a little short mini podcast that we like to call Fact Naturally Double Double.
Canadian edition. I like it.
This is going to be a Canada science centric, since we moved here, all we do is face Canadian stereotypes. Most of which are, all of which are completely innocuous, and if anything, just make people think I'm an actual better person than I am.
Mm. They hurt the feelings of the dogs in my dog sled, but...
I didn't get it, but you were telling a joke. Yeah. So we're going to focus on horrible Canadian stereotypes, or stereotypical Canadian ideas and objects, and we're going to actually talk about some science that might actually relate to any of those. We're going to talk about science news. And I think we might even have a little bit of a segment where we introduce you to some science, Canadian terminology, sorry, not even science. And the name of the show is Double Double, which we thought everyone in the world knew when we got here. But apparently they don't. That's actually how you offer or you order coffee in Canadian and Tim Hortons, which is a breakfast retail franchise. It's really the only one we've got.
It's good for more than breakfast, my friend. Lunch, like, dinner. I love my Timmy's.
And it's really the only thing we've got. It's completely displaced the entire donut ecosystem in Canada as really the only chain in which you can buy donuts. And Double Double is basically referring to how many sugars and how many cream you would like in your coffee. So you just say a Double Double, and that's two sugar, two cream.
It's delicious. That is my choice of coffee at Tim's.
I'm sorry that we streamlined the whole process and the world is the late adopter. So, so I chose the actual news story for this week. This should be a shorter podcast, but God knows. So, coming from Canada, we want to represent the science scene in Canada. And you don't really hear too much internationally, specifically about Canadian policy. You hear a lot about American policy, funding cuts throughout the world, really, in science. So, I thought, I'd kind of show how wonderful the ecosystem and the entire environment of research in Canada is going with an article from the Toronto Star, which is, it's actually the newspaper, but I was looking at the website of Toronto, which is the capital of Ontario, the province we're both from. Woo. And the title, it's an article written by Kate Allen, the title of which being Muzzling of Scientists, Subject to Unique Probe by Canada's Information Watchdog. So you know it's going to be a positive article.
They use both the words muzzle and watchdog in the headline?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Okay. So basically, the University of Victoria Environmental Law Center, University of Victoria is in British Columbia, so in conjunction with another nonpartisan group, Democracy Watch, have requested an investigation into quote-unquote systematic effects of Canadian government to obstruct the right of the media and, of course, the public by extension to timely access of government scientists. So basically, there's been all sorts of stories where after Canadian researchers are they're already actually publishing these articles. It's not like they're preventing people from publishing what they research. But when they're requested for interviews, there's a disturbingly high number of situations in which researchers who work for government divisions aren't actually being allowed to be interviewed by the Canadian media, or any media, really, for that case. Which, again, seems a bit archaic.
The best science is those that you can't question.
And so specifically, just a couple, I'll just mention a couple branches that includes. The inquiry is supposed to look at Environment Canada, the Natural Resources Canada, where I actually worked there for a year when I was growing up with a part-time job. It was great. I didn't do any research. And the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, among others. So the investigation is operating basically under an Access to Information Act. The original request, impressively, was actually a 128-page report by a law student, Clayton Greenwood, which basically detailed a bunch of these incidents where the media kind of ignored, or sorry, the government ignored the media's request to actually interview government researchers from some of these departmental divisions.
Did they ignore it or did they deny it?
Well, so it's all, this is where the bureaucracy comes into it. So there's always a justification. And actually someone, in response to this article being written, someone from the food or the science and technology department actually responded saying, it's complete access to all these researchers and there's no problems. Hmm. So I'll mention a couple examples though. Arguably the most famous example was by Christy Miller, who's a government fisheries researcher. And she actually published in the science journal Nature. Nature is one of the most eminent science journals that you can actually publish in. And she published a paper on salmon population decline in Fraser River. Fraser River runs through British Columbia. Basically, the salmon population decline in Fraser River is a really, really hotly debated topic about what sort of actions and whether or not there actually is a decline are hotly debated in British Columbia. So don't get me wrong, this paper was published and went out to one of the most eminent scientific journals. However, she was actually not given approval for interviews until 8 months after the study was actually published. And at that point, no one's probably going to actually want to interview you. Mm. It was justified by the government as saying she was to testify on a commission on the salmon decline, which was presumably towards actual action, towards how you should deal with it. Since then, so Nature, the journal itself, actually wrote an editorial talking about inability to access the researchers. Also, the magazine The Economist, The Guardian newspaper, they've all written out these controversies. So
why are they, why are government researchers not so allowed to talk to the media?
It kind of confuses me a lot. Like, presumably, so, of course, no one's, like, said anything really incriminating whatsoever. And this, of course, is, you know, this is like really on the cusp of there's no definites. Mm. Like making a whole proposal where you point out all these times that was really difficult. You know what I mean? It's a lot of gray area to deal with. So I don't think, first of all, nothing we should say is actually any kind of serious opinion on this for the most part.
But you can't muzzle fact naturally. You can't, not going to muzzle us.
You can't muzzle our repetition of well-established facts anytime soon. I do think it's really funny, though. Like, it is a, it seems like a bit of a misunderstanding about how science is published.
Yeah.
Like, these papers are getting published and read by the scientific community.
Yeah.
That being said, most of the articles in terms of public access are behind some kind of pay gate. So they aren't actually publicly accessible unless you're going to pay for the paper and actively seek it out.
Well, I wonder if it's because they don't want to be scooped then.
Well, but this is, they're only talking about the effects after a paper is published. Right.
Right.
So the way popular science works is a paper gets published and then a journalist will pick it up, interview the person, and then that's usually the main way that...
The press that, release, yeah.
That's the, and that's really the way that people who aren't affiliated, who can't access these journals, actually read about news.
On the flip side, universities love to have press releases.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so in defense, the guy... I didn't write down who the actual guy who gave the rebuttal was, or the response, I should say, not the rebuttal.
His name's been wiped from the records.
But they talked about, in, like, the last year that there was, like, 1,500 press releases the government was involved in, and over, like, a, you know, 1,500 papers published across all the divisions that they were talking about.
Hmm.
So it's not like they're not an active research group. It's just for some reason they don't want immediate press coverage. I say immediate, but it's also like I very much doubt that a journalist is think they're going to scoop someone if they're coming 8 months after a paper has been published. So I said that it is a big downer, and especially because something like government research really, it, like I always, you know, it's something that you always deem with a lot of like really great causes behind it, right? It's always... A lot of it's ecological and actually is there for protective purposes.
Mm.
And I'm sure a lot of it is taken into and actually being acted on. But, I mean, the point of science really is it should be disseminated, in my opinion.
It should be, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a complete downer to start to our first mini podcast. But Don't worry, because I think we only have positive things to say from now on.
Actually, no. So I'm going to open the next segment talking about the tundra, the frozen wastelands of Canada.
All right, well, after we get the lowest of the low, I'm going to rescue us because I'm going to talk about adorable beavers. So we'll be right back. Looking like it's gonna be another cold evening. Something like a couple degrees below freezing. And it don't stop, and it don't quit. The cold's coming, baby, don't forget. The weather turns on you in a single brief moment.
And we're back with the special Canadian edition of Fact Naturally, Double Double. I was gonna say, I actually do order Double Doubles at Tim's.
Yeah, me too. Anything, I would request a Triple Triple if I wasn't embarrassed.
Yeah.
Anything to get basically rid of the taste of Tim Hortons coffee.
Oh.
I'm not a fan of my national brand.
I am. Triple Triple is basically a cup of sugar and milk.
Yeah, that's the other reason I don't order it, is at that point you've impinged on less coffee than there are condiments.
Can I get a small Triple Triple, please?
Could you give me a cup of cream and just a couple packets of sugar I could suck on?
I also love those chocolate fudge donuts that aren't available at every branch. They're sort of like Boston cream, but instead of the cream, there's like chocolate filling.
Oh my god, I didn't even... I would prefer a Boston cream donut any day.
Chocolate fudge, and if not available, chocolate dip or... Hawaiian.
No, it's like chocolate sour cream glaze.
Chocolate sour cream glaze.
Yeah, it's my jam. You know they have sour cream and they also have sour cream glazed.
I know honey glazed. Yeah, I know
sour cream glazed, because you can get them without the glaze, but it's like, Ooh. Yeah, I really want this circle of bread, basically.
Well, that's a bagel.
And on that note, what a perfect segue into...
the tundra! So, I was thinking about... just general thoughts about Canada as a land, and one perception you sort of have of Canada, at least not along the 49th parallel where most of the population is that it's probably pretty cold. And in fact it is, and we'll get to that later. But the tundra is actually, it makes up nearly about 30% of Canada's geography, and most of which taking place above 60 to 75 degrees north, which in Canada is sort of right along the Northwest Territories border. Here in Scotland, the Shetlands are above 60 degrees north. Zach, do you remember the CBC show North of 60?
Oh man, no. It sounds like something I would avidly avoid.
It was on after Hockey Night in Canada, right before, what was it, Anne of Avonlea, I believe it was.
Thank God you're here to just fulfill all the stereotypes at the same time.
North of 60.
I was watching hockey, and I just kept the channel on.
It was advertised during Corch's Corner anyway. But yeah, north of 60, I realized today was actually a reference to north of 60 being where the tree line is. So tundra is actually a reference to where the soil is permafrost, or where the permafrost exists.
What?
The permafrost is defined by any soil that stays frozen or below 0 degrees Celsius for 2 years or more.
That sounds homey.
Yep, it's pretty terrible. Permafrost, and there's very little vegetation or flora growing around the area. Permafrost exists, again, above sort of the border of the Northwest Territories and higher parts of Quebec and the Yukon. Permafrost thaws just enough in the summer to let some degree of lichen and moss grow on the surface, but usually the lower levels or the lower layers of soil are all completely frozen.
I was going to say, in grade 9, which is my first year of high school, I did do a bristleboard presentation on the tundra. So I don't mean to insinuate that I'm a bit of an expert, but we also should not deny facts. So I was going to actually ask about moss and lichens, because I remember that. I also remember how to cut a slightly bigger title of cardboard and just put it right behind the printed pieces of paper so it has a beautiful border.
Ooh. Well then, Mr.
Life skills.
Mr. Expert, you'd know that the average temperature in the areas where basically the average temperature around the tundra year-round is about minus 28 degrees Celsius.
That sucks.
Can dip down as low as 50 degrees Celsius. It's interesting to note, though, minus
negative.
Yeah, minus 50 degrees.
I instantly assumed that temperatures didn't go that low. No.
It's almost absolute zero.
It isn't. That's not a science fact.
But the extreme temperatures there, it's important to note that that's not actually as cold as it gets in Canada. So the coldest temperatures in Canada and Russia are actually south of the tundra.
I wonder if it's got something to do with moisture, because I feel like, at least when you're a human and how you feel it, it's like a wet cold always feels way worse than a dry cold. I don't know, actually, now that I say that.
Well, we would know here in Scotland.
They're both horrible.
For those of you interested, the permafrosts takes quite some time to develop. So after a year of very cold temperatures, you can get permafrost up to about 16 or 14 feet or 4.4 meters.
Depth?
Depth-wise, yeah. But to get a really deep permafrost, so some permafrost goes down as far as, you know, nearly 700 meters or 2,300 feet. But to do that, it goes back farther back than 500,000 years to about 775,000 years ago to develop a really, really deep permafrost. So you can see this is not something that sort of changes year in and year out.
Yes.
And so when you hear in the news that the permafrost is thawing, that the tundra is sort of reclining, that makes, you know, it's undoing what could be even up to, you know, nearly 800,000 years. It's pretty scary stuff. And what I wanted to talk about today was the thawing of the permafrost. The sources I were reading were quick to point out that permafrost thaws, it doesn't melt. Think of it as if you leave your freezer open or take something out of your freezer, like take some meat or something out of your freezer, put it in the fridge, it doesn't melt, it thaws. So the natural nutrients of the soil and stuff just thaw out, and they don't go into some liquid phase. And it can make make some sort of problem. So before I go into the more serious thing, I'm going to point out something called drunken trees.
All right.
So you know those trees that sort of slant?
I saw those were my favorite Lord of the Rings characters.
You know those trees that sort of slant in sort of barren areas? You see pictures of them. They're not very tall, and they're sort of off to the side. They're actually called drunken trees, and you can have drunken forests. And basically, when you have permafrost on the very edge of the tree line and where the tree line starts to, well, where the trees start disappearing, basically, you can have trees grow, but they can't, the root system can't get very deep into the ground, because deeper into the ground, it's frozen, basically,
right?
And so what happens sometimes is that the tree roots try to cling into the ground, and then if that area, if the layer of soil where the tree roots are, either melts or refreezes, but usually when it thaws, sorry, not melts, when it thaws, it can cause some uplayering of the soil, and then the trees sort of just drop. They start to slant, the roots get pushed up a little bit. The thawing of the soil sort of expands, and the roots don't have quite a hold into the matrix of the soil anymore.
And with nowhere else to turn, the trees turn to the bottle.
And things get pretty bad for the trees out there. They have AA services out there, but they're poorly attended.
The automobile?
No, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Oh, I thought you were trying to be like AAA or C.
We could CAA.
Mention, here's a brief Canadianism. We also have a AAA, because here it's AAA, like the auto service.
Yeah.
I don't know what the first A stands for here.
Neither do I. Anglophile?
Yeah, that's it. And in Canada we have as well, and it is, yes, the CAA.
The CAA in Canada. Also,
and I was going to say the CAA probably does get horrible service up in the tundra.
Oh, I'm sure it does. It gets horrible service, you know, in South Central Ontario, let alone the tundra. When permafrost thaws, it can produce something that creates a thermokarst, which is basically the scientific name for a ground slump caused by thawing permafrost. So big lumps in the ground that say thermokarst. And what happens sometimes to when permafrost melts, the top layer, the surface layer, will gain some water in some standing sort of permafrost lakes, I suppose, which can be the breeding ground for tundra insects.
Hey.
Tundra insects, mosquitoes, and
not so barren.
Yeah, mosquitoes and gnats, and
oh,
they
God,
really
mosquitoes and gnats yeah. though. F that.
Yeah, no, they're they're not. They're stinging insects. Up in the tundra, that's a nice segment. Up in the tundra, you can have populations of caribou, muskox, and seals in the water, and lemmings, arctic hares, and some wolves and arctic foxes. They're are a few birds that stay there year-round, but there are many migratory species that go there for the summer. Even though it's still quite cold in the summer, it's at least warm enough that lichen and moss and some vegetation, small shrubs, can grow. So we have a lot of migratory birds going north for the summer.
You see a lot of them go to Alaska, too.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm assuming Alaska's a bit more temperamental or seasonal.
Yes, but they have their own layer of tundra up there too. Yeah. So, you know, sort of west of Yukon, you have a Alaskan tundra. But a lot of the research is done in Alaska. A lot of non-Canadian research is done on Alaskan permafrost. So snow geese and Canada geese go north to the tundra for the summer. So tundra, all well and good. And that does make up a good deal of our land mass in Canada. Now, what you would have heard of more and more in the news with global warming is the tundra or the permafrost thawing. And this is could be a real problem. So there's more and more ongoing research about this.
Well, if you let the devil convince you that global warming is a thing, Daniel.
If you subscribe to such thought, then you might also subscribe to some thought that the melting or the thawing, I keep on saying melting even though I just pointed out that it's not melting, the thawing of the permafrost will produce some big time problems. So the permafrost sort of forms. In the summer, vegetation will grow, and in the winter, there'll be a frozen layer on top of that. And after years and years and years, it builds up layers of just more or less frozen vegetation. So it's like if you keep your peas in the freezer for too long, they freeze. They don't decompose, they freeze.
And then if you're lazy like me, you just put something else on top of them.
Yes. And that's basically the tundra since, you know, even the last ice age. The problem is global warming is sort of thawing out more and more permafrost, and the tree line is pushing north and north. Tree line pushing north, permafrost thawing, and what it's doing is exposing these frozen plants that have been frozen for thousands of years. And when that happens, the plants decay and they produce carbon dioxide and methane. Methane being a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. There was a 2012 Russian study that showed that the permafrost, or with the thawing of the permafrost, it was exposing plants that had been frozen for over 3,000 years. And really interestingly, some of these plants, once they thawed, were alive. They were fertile. So global warming resurrecting plants from 3,000 years ago.
The tundra is my least favorite of the Jurassic Park trilogy. I think this is probably a good time to point out too that a lot of the effects you're talking about with the cyclicity and the seasonality of the tundra and all like the ground morphing and turning, a lot of that, I imagine, is probably the product of water. So as many of you probably know, when you freeze water at around 4 degrees, water actually changes in volume and it changes in structure, the way the different water molecules interact, called hydrogen bonding. Basically, at 4 degrees, they actually align with each other, whereas at a liquid phase, they just kind of can move around freely. And when they align with each other, they actually expand. And that's why ice takes up more space than water, because in ice, you've got all these water molecules aligned and taking up more space than when they're in a liquid phase. And so you can imagine if you have ground that's full of water and it freezes and thaws in a cyclical nature. Every time it does that, it kind of pulls and tears at whatever the water's inside.
I think that's actually what's creating the thermokarst.
There you go.
And the drunken trees. But yeah, the thawing of the permafrost, unleashing these plants from thousands of years ago, most of them aren't alive, and they decay. And when they decay, they give off carbon dioxide and methane. And that produces more and more greenhouse gases. And now this is very new research, and there's not been a great deal of scientific consensus about it. But there are estimates that it will produce a feedback loop. So as it gets warmer, the tundra warms up, more methane goes into the air, more carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere, producing or higher and higher temperatures. And it's just a sort of a positive feedback loop, and more of the Arctic will thaw.
I think you'll find that is a feed forward loop.
Oh, good point. Yeah, I suppose it is. And there are estimates anywhere from nearly 10% to nearly 35% of greenhouse gases could be unleashed by the Arctic. Now, this isn't going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years. This is speculated. If it does happen, could happen maybe a century from now. But the scary thing about that is that if that does start to happen, we won't be able to stop it. It will just start to naturally occur in the planet.
Yeah, it gets to a point where it's just out of our hands.
Now, to present the other side as well, as Zach mentioned earlier, not everybody subscribes to the thought of global warming.
Oh, no.
It's true, and some scientists, some do, or don't subscribe to the thought of global warming, and they say that the thawing of the permafrost is sort of happening as the end of the last ice age.
Yeah, it's God punching the ground really hard.
And they say that after every ice age, it takes a very long time for the planet to warm up, and then a very long time for it to cool down again.
Yeah.
And there's some degree of thought that the thawing of the permafrost in the north is happening as a natural result of the end of the very tail end of the last ice age. So there is that thought to present both sides.
Not to say that they're mutually exclusive. You can believe in the fact that there are rhythms throughout history, but it's also kind of crazy to deny the fact that humans haven't had a significant impact on those in the past little while.
It's true. And to give you an idea, there are estimates, and they need to update these estimates. The best estimate of the amounts of carbon dioxide trapped in the tundra was actually by a Canadian scientist, to keep with the theme, a guy named Charles Tarnocke. I probably butchered his last name. He could be Quebecois, I'm not sure. Anyway, he and his team estimated that there's about 1.7 trillion tons of carbon in the soils in the north, of which about 88% is locked up right now in permafrost. And with the continuous thawing of the permafrost, a lot of that could be released in theory. Now, that is a figure that they admittedly say needs to be worked on some more and recalculated by other teams. But that gives you an idea of how much carbon is just trapped up there through thousands of layers.
Yeah, and it's just carbon, too. Parts. So, I mean, yeah. That'll be locked up in all sorts of stuff aside from CO2.
True. But, yeah, that's the story on the tundras of Canada.
The cold and desolate wasteland. And also the part above it called the tundra.
And we don't want to offend our many listeners that live north of 60.
But we hate you. We hate you, north of 60.
Statistically speaking, you don't really exist.
You don't even know what kind of business we're running under 60.
And honestly, you guys don't have the internet anyway, right? Anyway, we're going to go to a break. And when we come back, what do we got, Zach?
I'm going to talk about our nation's creature, right? It's a... Canada's, what do you call it? Canada's animal? Canada's
national animal?
Canada's number one animal.
The moose.
I'm not talking about moose. We'll be right back. Hockey and bred the greatest players, Gretzky to Crosby. We all got at least one drinking buddy. And after one drink, all of us think we're funny. A national mascot's a damn beaver. Oh, Canada, we love our beaver. Home of Hell's Angels and RCMP. And we're back. After following up on Dan, I am here to talk about our nation's creature. So Canada actually has its national animal is the beaver. Dan saw me pull out my iPhone. I am now setting a 1-minute timer so that Dan can make all of his gross, immature beaver jokes. And go.
Beavers are national animal. Oh, God. I didn't know we were doing this. You mean like... beaver, like...
I already want to die.
Beaver, as in, I got nothing.
That was a really good one. I thought that one had a lot of inspiration to it.
Beaver, you mean the animal or? I got nothing.
Why would you mop a floor with that? I don't understand. It's a small woodland critter. I'm gonna just chalk this one up to my good idea, because now you feel silly every time you try to make a real beaver joke. All right, so I am here to talk maturely about Canada's wonderful national animal. So I thought I would eventually focus on the three major structures that beavers build. But beavers can reach up to, or 60 and above pounds, which is around 27 kilograms. Mm-hmm. So quite a hefty little animal. They're also a rodent, in case you didn't know. And in fact, they're only the second largest rodent. Do you actually know what the largest rodent is?
I do. It's the capybara.
It is the capybara. Excellent. I've seen a capybara, and the one I saw didn't look very big.
It looked like a mix of a pig and a rat.
Yeah, but it didn't look very big, so I assumed it was just very dense, because at the time I knew that it was the biggest rodent.
Not to be confused with the chupacabra,
the
which
chupacabra?
Hunts goats. Yeah.
Oh, jeez. That's the third heaviest rodent. So, beavers eat trees. Fact. So beavers don't actually eat all of the tree. They actually eat one very specific part of trees, which is a layer just beneath the bark called the cambium, which actually is a pretty good name.
Cambium.
Yeah, so the cambium is actually a group of three layers. Two of the layers are transport tubes where you get water full of nutrients as well as products of photosynthesis. So sugars.
Xylem and phloem.
Pardon?
Xylem and phloem.
Yes. Oh my God, you actually knew the names. I didn't write them down because I couldn't pronounce them. And in between the xylem and phloem,
biology coming in strong.
In between the xylem and phloem is the actual layer of cambium, which is cells that just replace the xylem and phloem, which are the phloem. Two names.
Phloem, phloem.
It's phloem or something. And they use the rest of the wood. So after they strip, the bark off, they eat the next layer, and what's left is what they actually use for construction. And what they chew up, they actually use for lining.
Okay.
These beavers use all parts of the tree. Respectable. So as I mentioned, beavers are prolific builders. They build predominantly for defense, so protection from predators, mainly by controlling the water line. They constantly want their entrances to wherever they stay to be underwater. So they do not build alone. They typically are living in families of up to 8 members. That includes 2 adults, who are the parents, the kits, which are the name of the young, which is adorable.
Kit?
Yeah, kit.
Oh.
So this year's kits, and then also the year before kits. And so, and then after that, so after you're a year old, then I guess you get booted, and you go out and find your own.
You're out on your own at that point, yeah.
So I mentioned that they can build up the 3 types of structures. However, they don't need them all. For minimum requirements, all they really need is hardwood trees for food. And all they actually need is a burrow. They don't even necessarily need any building materials. Huh. For a burrow, the minimum requirements are basically an entrance underwater and that the nest chamber is above the water so that they don't drown because they still breathe air. Mm-hmm. So newly mated pairs of adults will seek out a burrow location. So ideally, they're looking for a pond that has a steep bank so they can burrow into it. They dig into the bank at least 1 foot below the waterline. So again, always underwater. And they dig at an upward angle until they're above the waterline where they can build a chamber so that, again, they can swim under, get into their chamber, and then that's where they hang out, and that's where they're safe. However, one crazy thing is if they dig up and they're actually going to hit the surface before they hit the waterline, so if the waterline is really close to the surface of the pond, they'll actually, before they build a chamber, they'll go back outside onto the surface and actually pile sticks where they're going to dig up through the ground.
Oh.
So when they hit it, they already have a roof there.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and so the pile of sticks is what we actually call a lodge. The whole structure is actually a lodge. So it would just be a burrow if they wouldn't actually put sticks on top of it, but they actually build a ceiling ahead of time. Then they make their chamber below it. And that is a lodge. So it's really cool. And then the last step is enlarging and lining their chamber. So they line their chamber with mud, sticks, and chewed up bark for when they're actually stripping the trees. We've actually put cameras inside. I haven't personally, but I'm very interested in doing it actually now after I read this stuff. The chambers they get are around 6 feet in diameter, which is my height, which is 1.8 meters. I can do that conversion because I know how tall I am. And 18 inches tall, so not super tall, but they're not very tall animals.
No.
And the other interesting thing is there's at least 2 entrances, so they actually add additional entrances afterwards.
See, now the jokes are flooding to mind, but forget it.
Thank God you forgot it. One unique characteristic about the construction by the beavers that nobody ever really talks about, and it's because this is the kind of stuff that's so difficult to actually test without experiments, is the flexibility. So there's lots of evidence that they're actually quite flexible about how they build and what they do, because obviously if they're looking just for a pond and all they need to do is have an entrance underwater, they're going to come into all sorts of different ponds with different configurations. There might be other dams there, so they might be restricted in terms of what space they get. So what's going to happen if they don't have a steep bank, for example, to burrow into in a pond? Well, they make a solution. They can excavate down into the pond floor and then make a steep bank out of it.
Okay.
They also have been found to build up a bank on the surface and dig up into it.
Okay.
They also have been found to build their own island.
Oh.
They actually take rocks and stones and build a foundation. On top of that, they put mud and sticks to make a floor. And then they build a stick roof on top of that and make their own lodge island.
Oh,
with still an entrance underwater.
So fairly solitary animal, this.
No, they live in families.
Oh, of course they do.
They've also been found to churn a lodge that was attached to the side of the shore into an island by excavating a 5-foot moat around it. Isn't that crazy?
Awesome. That is pretty cool. Yeah,
yeah, like so there's all these are all just kind of anecdotal, but they are evidence that they seem quite flexible in terms of how they approach a situation. Someone has actually put infrared cameras, and so you mentioned that beavers seem to be quite solitary animals, but through the use of infrared cameras, they also found that they seem to share their lodges with muskrats, Mice, water voles, and large flying insects, and they don't seem to mind the presence of these other animals.
Large flying insects?
Yeah, I didn't know what they meant by that. I'm assuming like a dragon.
Even if they don't want them there, what are they going to do? Just like swat at the flies?
Well, presumably they could scare out some of the smaller mammals. But I thought that was hilarious, just putting the infrared. And their report was that they actually, they've seen all these things, and the beavers just don't seem to mind whatsoever. Yeah. They just continue on.
I wonder if you threw like a cat in there, what it would do.
They might start getting bothered by that.
Yeah, I guess a cat's a little bigger.
Actually, here I should also mention that when we're talking about flexibility, you know how I said that the minimum requirements are a burrow?
Yep.
They don't require a burrow.
Oh.
I lied.
Misinformation. You're in fact naturally.
So because beavers actually spread all the way up through North America, and down in Florida, some people have found beavers living in secluded caves with no excavation whatsoever, and they don't need to enclose the cave because the weather's good enough.
Ah.
And the situation of the cave is far enough out of predators, or there aren't any nearby predators, so they don't need to build. Does that mean they know what they're doing? That's a bit much to presume. But they do seem quite plastic in their behavior. So the next structure is, of course, the most famous, and that is a dam. A beaver dam. Yeah, there you go. One, two. Ha! And the dam is a primary means of controlling the water line. So again, if you don't have space to burrow, this is another way you can bring the water line up, and now you've got all sorts of space to burrow an underground entrance.
All right, I got a better joke. Just give me 3 seconds.
Okay.
I was building a bit of a creek once to bring some water into these sheep that I was farming. And I noticed one day the water stopped going there, and I walked by and I noticed this beaver that felled a bunch of trees, and the water wasn't trickling through, and I thought to myself, damn!
I thought that was a really great story until you ruined it by making it fictional and a joke. I was like, damn, it was a shepherd.
That's the best part, actually.
Why is it important to control the water line? It's especially important in very temperate places like Canada because of seasonal changes. So you get summer and autumnal decreases in the water line. So by building a dam and holding a reservoir of water, so basically a dam will flood the local area. You'll have more water sitting around there. Can turn like a small part of a stream into basically a pond, potentially. And that will actually mediate the effects of seasonal changes in the water line. You'll get less loss and less flooding when you get heavy rains. So the dangers is if the water line falls, you expose your lodge entrance, which predators might come. And even if that water line lowers and then winter comes, you could actually block yourself into a lodge by freezing up your entrance with ice. So most of what we know about actual dams is from L.H. Morgan, or most of what I found, who is in the 1860s was in charge of building railroads throughout the U.S. And he seemed to have a hell of a time dealing with building culverts to divert water under the roads, especially if beavers wanted the water to go just over the whole area. So in terms of dam building, it's a pretty straightforward thing. It's a pile of sticks. And it's packed with mud and branches and vegetation. However, even then, they still show some flexibility in terms of how they actually build a dam. So two techniques that have been documented. This first one really blew my mind, that they will actually... So the way they actually chew away at trees, the ends of the sticks actually are quite pointed. And they'll actually bury and drive those sharpened ends into the ground. Obviously, the hardest part about building a dam is getting it started. Another way is they actually will fell a tree that's beside a stream, so that it falls across it, and I hope it's a big enough mass, I guess.
How long do you think it takes for a beaver to fell it, or a fair-sized tree?
I actually saw this on a website with no citations, but it said 20 minutes for an 8-inch tree, I guess.
It's not so bad.
So basically, after they get the main structure, like I said, they add additional branches and supports, and then plug the holes with mud and vegetation, and do not pat it in with their tails.
Oh.
I put in brackets, sadly. Oh yeah, so the priority to raise the water line as a function of what a lot of beaver constructions are has been shown in situations with no dam. And the best example I got was an anecdote where someone tried to keep two beavers in confinement, but in a big enclosure with a pool. And the pool had, a totally normal filtration system. Probably no chlorine in it. But basically, the water level in the pool wasn't up high, the highest it could have been. So the beavers went in and they found where the outlet drain was for the pool, and they blocked it up with a bunch of mud and sticks so the water level would rise.
Did they use pool noodles?
And then, no, sadly, it wasn't that recreational of a setting. And the zookeepers came and cleaned the pipe. And then we'd come back the next day, it would be plugged up again with even bigger.
And the zookeeper more... said, damn!
very small, selective, more of a plug, really. So they actually show, even without building a dam, that they're sensitive to the idea of where this water is going. Another really interesting, crazy thing beavers do, and this is getting back to the freezing of water in this winter, is so you built your lodge, you've got your underground entrance, you've got your dam, so the water level's nice and high, well above your entrance. You don't have to worry about the water line going down and getting frozen in your lodge. The water freezes. Mm. You're now stuck inside of a frozen pond, and the ice is too thick to break through. This means when you're swimming around, you've got to go all the way back to your lodge if you ever want to get air. So what do beavers do? This is awesome.
I hope they chew through the ice.
They go over to their dam, and they break a little bit off the top of their dam, and that drains some of their water, but it produces an entire layer of air beneath the layer of ice, so that they have air accessible anywhere in their pond.
I like that.
Isn't that crazy?
They are clever.
So we've covered lodges, and we've covered dams, and now we're getting to what I think is everything about beavers is awesome, and if I haven't proven to you now, is the time. So if the ground's flat enough in the right areas, so you build your lodge, you build your dam, you've lasted the winter thanks all right. to your clever adaptive behavior. But all the trees around your pond are gone because you ate them and you built with them. And if you're a beaver, like I said, you've got these short, stubby arms, and you can't really move logs on land, right?
Right. Yeah.
The real advantage of swimming around in water and being a specialist swimmer is that you can move these giant logs and they just don't weigh that much because right, they float. Yeah. You're not actually lifting them. So what are you going to do? You're going to run out of food. Mm. You're going to run out of building materials, and you constantly have to repair your dam and your lodge.
I hope they build another river to where the trees are.
That's exactly what they do. Nice. The third structure, it's kind of a structure that they can do, is they can excavate canals. And this is actually one of the things that L.H. Morgan saw when he was trying to build railroads, is that if the ground's flat enough, the beavers will actually dig canals outward from their pond and fell all the trees beside their canals, and then so they can eat them, and they can actually wash their branches downstream back into their pond.
That's really impressive.
And so there's not too much on beavers. There is some great things, though, but they all tend to be anecdotes like these. But there's plenty of evidence that they seem quite flexible, and they seem to at least know what they need in the end. They need, they seem to understand... Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't want to say these loaded words, but they seem to recognize that a higher water level is a good thing. Actually, we'll go to all sorts of means to get there.
We'll be right back after this break, and I'm gonna put Zach's Canadian knowledge to the test.
We'll be back.
And counting loonies, trying not to say, I hate Winnipeg. The driver checks the mirror.
And we're back with Fact Naturally, episode double, the Canadian edition.
Eight.
We were talking about tundra and talking about sort of climate areas of Canada. I'm going to test Zach on his knowledge of the weather systems of Canada.
You guys are going to find out why I stopped studying this stuff after I met my minimum scholastic requirements in high school.
Here's your actual first question. Canada gets very cold in the winter, or many parts.
True.
What's...
Oh.
No. Name the coldest Canadian city in the wintertime. The coldest, now I say city, so an actual metropolitan area.
Okay. I'm going to guess Edmonton?
Actually, no. No. In fact, it is Winnipeg. Oh. Takes it by a fair bit. So the prairies seem to get very, very cold in the winter.
That makes sense. It's just the wind, too, I
imagine. Yeah. But Winnipeg has an average temperature in the wintertime of minus 15.3, followed closely by Saskatoon at minus 14.8, and Saguenay, minus 13.9-ish, according to this one source I'm reading.
I would have never guessed Quebec.
I'm going to give you a multiple choice question, though. Of the metropolitan cities in Canada... metropolitan cities in Canada. What has the record low? Is it A, Saskatoon, B, Regina, C, Winnipeg, or D, Calgary? Now, this took place, this is reported anyway, on February 1st, 1893.
Oh, so like my heyday.
Yeah. Actually, looking at this now, there's two. They both hit this. So which two of those options?
I'm going to guess... Saskatoon.
Yep.
And Regina.
You're absolutely right, yeah.
Woo! I figured if it
side
was...
Side by side, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to pick the two that were close together.
Saskatoon hit minus 50 degrees Celsius on February 1st, 1893, and Regina minus 50 January 1st, 1885.
We literally cannot provide you with more evidence as to why you should just stick to Ontario.
According to ocanada.com, which exists, who is the hottest Canadian man?
It's not
man?
Even ocanada.ca.
No.
ocanada.com.
Actually, it's o.canada.com.
Oh, that's
kind of who is the best or the hottest Canadian man? Is it A, actor Keanu Reeves? B, actor Ryan Gosling? C,
you don't have to ask anymore.
It's actor Ryan Reynolds. It's Ryan actor Gosling. Ryan Reynolds.
Oh,
or
no.
D, a guy named Drake. I'm not sure who that is. I think a rapper.
He's a rapper. Yeah. It's gotta be Ryan.
Who do you think's hotter?
I think Ryan Gosling is.
I would have said Jim Carrey actually, but
It's Ryan Reynolds then. He won like a million titles.
Ryan Gosling, according to our sources over at OCanada.com. Anyway, there you go. The hottest and coldest of Canada. Right
I'm
there.
Sorry that I'm not an expert on a hot man like you are.
Hey, if Mike Myers was on the list.
Oh, gross.
If John Candy was there.
I'd love that guru. What a blockbuster.
Yeah.
So that was our first in what is probably going to be an extremely sporadic series of mini podcasts.
Double.
But with that, thank you for tuning in.
Take off, Hosen.
I don't know what this is all about.
Once upon a time, I was falling in love.
How does Total Eclipse
now
of the Heart
go? Now I'm only falling apart from that.
Oh, really?
Nothing I can do, it's a total eclipse of the heart.
I definitely don't even know this song.
Turn around, bright eyes.
Total eclipse of the heart, it's temporarily dark inside my body. Wait, why was there light coming from my heart anyway?
My heart is a
far be it for me to question the artistic merits in this song.
Meatloaf.